it, but at least we have something of a record.
Yeah, it's okay, never mind.
Okay, I'm recording the audio.
Yes, sir. Hi, everyone. Today we are really delighted to have Dr. Spad in this Zoom call. Before starting, I want to draw your attention to the following part. This workshop is a non-traditional one. It is not a lecture. It is more like an interview. I have some questions to Dr. Spad, who hopefully is going to answer. After or through discussion, you may generate your own questions, in which Dr. Spad is going to answer at the end of the talk. What remains is to say something about Dr. Spad. Ben Spad is a non-binary researcher and theorist of embodied practice. He is senior lecturer in drama, theatre and performance at the University of Huddersfield, UK. And he's the author of a very well-known book, which is called What a Body Can Do, wrote in 2015, A Blue Sky Body, 2020, and Making a Leap Poetry in 2020, as well as editor of the Videographic Journal of Embodied Research and co-convener of the International Embodied Research Working Group. Experience as a performer and director of contemporary theatre, and has been invited to present at nearly 30 institutions in 11 countries. I hope one day Dr. Spad can come and present here in Iraq. It will be a very great honor, and we will be happy here at the University of Anbar, not at the University of Anbar, but at Iraq universities in general. Yes, Dr. Spad, I will start my questions. Do you want anything to say before I start my question?
No, just thank you so much for inviting me. This is it's really wonderful to be having this conversation. I'm honored. Thank you.
I start my question with your book, which is called What Can a Body Do? You begin the book by describing a fascinating project of yours that posed the question, what can a body do? Can you describe how you came to imagine such a project?
Well, I think the question what a body can do came a little bit later, actually, than the central idea of the book, which is technique. I really the project that I was working on then was to think about technique in a really different way than I had seen it ever thought about. And that came from the fact that I had spent quite a lot of my time, quite a lot of my life since an early age, training and exploring fields of acting, theater act, theatrical acting, dance, different forms of dance, many different forms of dance, martial arts, several different forms of martial arts, and things that are between dance and theater and martial arts, and singing, and all of these kinds of possible ways of working with embodiment. And then I was in this theater PhD program, and it was, I think theater is, you know, it's the field, the academic field that I most fit in a way, but the framework of theater was really, I felt it was really limiting because of the assumptions that were made about theater, which were, to my mind, still built on a very Eurocentric idea of what theater is, a very specific history of that becomes focused on the dramatic text. It becomes based on a very specific kind of audience performance relationship, very strict division, and all of these things that had to do that are really just a specific cultural tradition of theater were somehow the focus. And I wanted to shift the focus and say, which of course performance studies has always done, and I was very much engaged with that, but I think I felt that, and I still feel that, the idea of performance, while it can be very radical, the way it operates in performance studies is still attached to that vision of theater. It doesn't escape totally from that idea, from that Eurocentric, text-based, logocentric idea of theater. It's a push away from that, but it's still it's still referring back to it in some way. And I wanted to get away from that and really try to recenter on the ways of learning that we undertake in spaces of practice. And I've always felt that was also the category of embodiment, and embodied practice is much broader even than the context I mentioned. So I'm not only speaking about dance and acting and martial arts. Hello, someone else. I'm also speaking about other kinds of embodied practice that are related to everyday life and related to our identities, our gender identities, and all the other identities that we have. And I just was trying to figure out how to start thinking about that. And so I came to this idea of technique as a way to think about that. And then this kind of led me to this question, what can a body do, which is it has a history in philosophy that comes from Spinoza and then goes through French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, which I'm interested in that history, but that's not primarily where I'm coming from. So I didn't, it's not, it's a little bit of a, it's a link that I'm trying to create to that philosophical history, but it doesn't actually come from that. It actually comes from a kind of tracking of my own embodied experience and trying to get a handle on, in some kind of academic way, scholarly way, a handle on what it is to have a body or to be a body, and all these questions around embodiment.
It's great. I take one of your central arguments in the book to be that embodied knowledge underlies social practice, specifically in the form of technique. You put it very nicely on page 57. You said technique is a network of fulfillment that gives structure to practice. What do you think is useful to sociologists of the body about your concept of technique?
Well, I think that there are strengths and limitations to the way that critical thinking and all kinds of critical analysis have developed in the university as I know it, which is primarily in North America and Europe that I know what the university is, but I know something about universities in other parts of the world. But the way that it's developed, which I think is closely related to the technology of printing and the way that writing circulates, and now, of course, digitally, there is something very powerful about the way that this kind of analysis steps back from the world and analyzes it at a distance. There's a kind of distancing technique that's used where the person who's in this position of analyzing or researching steps away from, or attempts to step away from what they're analyzing, and to gain distance on it and to gain objectivity on it. I think that it's very clear that that is a very powerful and effective thing to do in certain contexts, because in some ways it's, for example, it's given us technology and contemporary technology. But all of these things have double edges, technology included. But I think particularly if we're studying society or we're studying humans or we're studying life, there's a great value in getting that critical distance, but it can also lead to serious problems. I mean, thinking about sociology, thinking about anthropology, those are disciplines that are bound up in the history of colonialism, and the methodologies are colonial. They can also be seen as patriarchal. And that's bound up with the kind of basic principle that you separate yourself from what you're studying. You take your body out of it by channeling your being through text. And the knowledge is understood to be in the text. And one of the things that even if you take a really critical approach, so you say, well, this is not, you know, let's get away from colonial sociology, let's get away from colonial anthropology, let's develop a really critical anthropology or a radical anthropology or sociology. As long as you stay in the methodology that's based on text, the most you're going to be able to do in a way is point towards problems, point towards issues, and potentially begin to suggest possible solutions in textual form. But you're not going to necessarily be able to undertake a truly experimental approach. You're not necessarily going to be able to dive in and propose new possibilities. And I wanted to think about how that could be. I mean, ultimately, I have an ambiguous feeling and an ambiguous relationship to the university as an institution. So I'm thinking, how can we retain some of the critical powers of the university, but how can we also change the structure of the university so that it is more active? And this relates even to political performance. How can we activate the politics beyond a framework of performance, if by performance we mean theatrical conventions? How can we activate that more? And of course, you can link that directly to histories of activism. But I ended up feeling like I was occupying a kind of middle place, where I was saying, well, I still want the critical distance. I still want the critical theory and the critical kind of approaches. But I also want to be able to take an experimental approach, which means that I'm going to need more than the sociological tools. Which, for example, the examples I talk about in the book are Pierre Bourdieu, Foucault, and Judith Butler. Excluding the later Foucault, but there's a lot of sociological tools for looking at embodied practice, looking at embodiment, and naming the structures of power that inscribe the body, the ways that the body is disciplined. There's been a big focus on the control of the body, and there's been a less of a focus or less of a capacity on thinking and going beyond thinking in terms of the kind of the liberation of the body, the freeing of embodiment, what that would look like, and is there a way to kind of experiment with that in a way that is still methodologically rigorous, that doesn't take you out of the university exactly, but rather changes the structure of the university? So what I found was that by thinking of embodied technique as fields of knowledge, not an object of knowledge and not even a single field of knowledge, but whole vistas and fields and landscapes of knowledge, I started to see this could open up a kind of other way of thinking about the university, where it's still a university, it's still conducting research, there is still some of this distancing happening. Distancing and critical thinking is still very important, but at the same time, it's not locked within that, because the fields of knowledge that we're operating with can also be fields of practice and fields of embodiment. And so can that be a way to maybe think of some new ways of structuring institutions, particularly the university, but maybe not only the university? So I think, in a nutshell, what does it offer to sociological or anthropological fields is it offers a way of thinking about the other side of things. So in addition to analyzing critically what the practice is, it offers a way to think about how the practice changes. And it's not just a question of habits change, trends change, again, this distance analysis of tradition changed, tradition was invented. But it's saying, no, it's a much more intentional the way these things change. Trends and cultures and traditions change because of motivated experimentation. It's not just that the tradition changed, and neither is it that the tradition changed because some top-down ideology came in and forced it to change. Of course, that can happen, but when we look at other kinds of more complex change and change from the bottom up, what's motivating that change is not just a random kind of, oh, let's do it this way instead of this way. It's a motivated experimental process of, well, how can we do this? How can we adjust this tradition? How can we adjust this ritual? How can we adjust this form to address specific demands? And that is a kind of research. And I wanted to really make that claim.
In relation to this argument, you call for doing research in the arena of embodied practice, both in everyday life and the university. Can you describe what you mean by this methodological innovation and its import for rethinking the boundaries of the academy?
Yeah. I mean, for me, that book is it's just a starting point. It's just a foundation. It offers, in a sense, really one tool, which is this idea of technique as knowledge. And then how can things be restructured? I mean, I think in terms of the concrete restructuring of the university as an institution, I don't feel like I'm in a position to say anything grand about that. There are very important projects that are addressing that. I would think of certainly some work in anthropology that attempts to activate anthropology, take an activist approach to anthropology, where the people who previously would have been thought of as research objects are encountered on a truly reciprocal level, and that's a radical attempt. I think that's important. I think what Stefano Harney and Fred Moten have written about in terms of different kinds of study coming from Black studies in the university, and a kind of almost antagonistic, subtle relationship to the university is also very important. But I guess the place that I've landed is this kind of field of artistic research, or practice as research, performance as research, embodied research. It's called research creation. It can be called arts integrated research. There's all these different terms. But what people mean is that the arts, and it's, you know, that's a content, for me, the arts is a contentious idea. But the arts should also be understood as fields of knowledge. They should be understood as research. And what does that look like? And I think, I guess I have this ambiguous relationship to that, to the way those things are developing, where I find it very exciting. I find it very important. It's certainly been really important to me because it's allowed me to really search for new structures, new academic structures that are quite different from the text-based ones that I was trained in. But I guess I would say this link that I start to call for or propose between the arts, understood again as a contained kind of performing arts, fine arts, and everyday life, is not, it's not really, it's only, I don't know exactly what that looks like. I'm still kind of working on it. I'm still looking for examples of what that could look like. I know other people who are working on that, but I actually think as long as we stay within the arts, we're not really going to get there, because again, in this same kind of Eurocentric tradition that I'm familiar with, that I was raised in, the arts as performing arts or fine arts are separated from, on the one hand, they're separated even from things which are clearly specialized, like martial arts, healing arts, other things, craft arts. So there's areas of arts where it's clearly also specialized knowledge, but it's not getting treated as art because it doesn't have a specific type of public manifestation as a work. And that, I think, we need to really cross that boundary. But even if you include martial arts and healing arts and craft arts, or supposedly called craft arts or traditional arts, those are still all specialized areas. And so there's an even more radical possibility of thinking everyday practices as fields of knowledge. Now, it's really tricky because if it's going to be a field of knowledge, if it's going to be a research field, it still needs to be framed somehow. I mean, as soon as you start talking about technique and trying to break things down and develop methods, working methods, you're not going to be tackling everything. You're going to be making certain assumptions. I mean, there's no way, I think, to take everyday life as a method, in a sense, because I think it's too broad. It's too everything. It's like taking embodiment itself as a method. And I think what interests me is always staying in this dialogue with research and with methodology and saying, okay, well, what's the next thing we could include as a field of knowledge? So let's say we include performing arts, but we also include martial arts. Well, let's say we also include healing arts. That really starts to go in a different direction. Let's say we include craft arts. If we include craft arts, if we include traditional arts, if we include ritual arts, then we're starting to border on religion, which is an area that I've been more exploring in the last several years. And of course, It's not possible to contain religious practice within what we call the arts. That's this whole kind of secularization premise where we say, well, if you're, you know, as long as it's not really the religion, then it can be an art, and then maybe it could be research. But I've been pushing through that, through this kind of investigation of Jewishness that I've been doing in the last 5-6 years, to say, well, what is this thing? Because it's kind of a religion in some context. It's also an ethnicity in some context. It can be a racialized identity in other contexts. It's this very slippery, complex thing like most identities, but this is one that I've been wrestling with. So what would that look like as a field of knowledge or as fields of knowledge? What does it look like to move towards that in a research framework, not as an object, but as a method or as a field? I think it's a step-by-step thing. I don't think you can suddenly open up to all of everyday life or all of human practice and say, well, this is the new field. I mean, you can do that, but you're not in a university anymore because you've thrown out all of the critical distancing and textual techniques. Whereas I'm again in this kind of middle place where I'm saying, well, how can we push in that direction? What would it look like to take religion or racial or ethnic identity or gender identities as fields of knowledge and to make that claim? What would the spaces look like? So I'm looking at new kinds of laboratory. You know, this most recent work is about rethinking what the laboratory is. Not throwing out the laboratory. I'm really interested in the laboratory. I'm really interested in the theater laboratory tradition. But saying, okay, how can we restructure this? So that because we don't need to only be working with textual documents, we can work with other kinds of documents. And that has implications for who is in the lab, what the roles are in the lab, who has expertise, who has knowledge, where the site of knowledge is, the meaning of place. And so it connects with a lot of the questions that have been asked in various critical areas of academia and activist movements as well. But from this question of method, which for some reason it seems to be a place that I want to push.
Yeah, interesting. Dr. Spatz, I only wonder, and my student may also wonder, how can take literature into the lab? Literature is not an experience to be done. How can make it something new, something a trick, as you said?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I want to say that my thinking about that was deeply changed by an encounter with a performer who's also an anthropologist named Caroline Gatt. I had previously been treating the embodied practice laboratory as very separate from the space of critical academic thought. And that's because of my training. I mean, I had this possibility to make theater, and then I was learning about the theater laboratory tradition in Poland, and so I was working in this very process-oriented way of embodied experimentation, but then separately in another universe, I was also doing my PhD training and all that. So they really seemed very separate to me, and I think it's not only that the PhD training explicitly excluded embodied practice, but also the theater laboratory tradition explicitly excluded certain kinds of critical thinking. So they were mutually rejecting each other. And so I was developing a laboratory space that was very focused on embodiment, almost a kind of idea of a pureness of embodiment. Not I wouldn't have used that term really, but I was trying to kind of separate or draw a boundary around embodiment. And Caroline Gatt visited our laboratory in 2017. And she brought with her this work that she's been developing on the embodiment of relationship to writing, to books. She particularly had been drawing on the medieval and post-medieval history of the embodied relationship to books, which of course was much more, let's say, full-bodied, or at least had very different embodied techniques than it does right now. There are traditions of reading aloud, even to oneself. There are the traditions of reading aloud to other people. And of course, these still exist in religious contexts very much, where you know, if there's a text that's, if there's a book that's considered very, 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 very important, one doesn't just sit at home and read it. You know, there are many techniques, embodied techniques for engaging with a written work, by reading it aloud, by reading it together, by chanting it rather than reading it in an everyday way, by singing it, by writing it over and over, by moving while reading it. So I think there are many, many techniques for working with books in a very embodied way. In the university tradition that I know of literature, we don't use those techniques, actually. In my undergraduate training and my doctoral training, I wasn't studying literature, but I was massively studying books. I was massively reading and reading and reading. I was occasionally invited, perhaps, to read a passage out loud. But I was probably never invited to read something out loud several times, like to repeat, to read it in repetition. I don't think I was ever asked to chant or to sing anything I read. I was never asked to move or to interact with other people while reading. So these techniques of engaging with books are just abandoned. And we've taken this other technique, which again is culturally specific, of sit down, be still, read it, and then we'll talk about it, which in my mind produces the mind-body split. That's not a result of the mind-body split. I think that's the origin of the mind-body split, essentially, is this technique of relating to words, to writing specifically. Because as soon as you say, sit down and read silently to yourself, and then we'll talk about it, you have made a split between all the fields of embodied practice and the specific technique of reading, which then starts to more and more look like the technique of thinking, and it ends up creating this idea of the mind, there's no mind like that. It's just the technique of reading, essentially. So I think the first thing I would say is we can change our relationship to reading and to books. I don't think it happens quickly. I mean, this is why I think it requires research. But I think as we relate to literature and as we relate to all kinds of theoretical books, historical books, because I'm not suggesting, oh, well, we should treat those books the way that we treat religious canonical books. I'm not saying that because it has to be experimented with. It's an experimental process to say, how might we reconnect the current flow of books and words and writing back to some of the embodied techniques that exist for engaging with each other and for learning and for study. I've been, for example, in the last several years, really focusing a lot on how video actually can change that relationship, because video is this very strange thing. It's quite historically new. I mean, you know, before the advent of cinema, there wasn't anything that was like video where you can look at. I mean, video is is ontologically a very specific, unique thing, and it's historically new. And it has some of the qualities of a kind of live embodied encounter that writing doesn't have, because you see the visual and the sonic, the audiovisual, the way you're seeing me now, you hear my voice. This is a different presence than when you're reading my words, right? Very different. But it also has a lot of features that writing has, which is that, for example, we can communicate across thousands of miles. We're not all in the same room at all, and we're very far away, and yet we're communicating. So it has this other feature, and it can be recorded and saved, which is more like writing. So for me, thinking about video and exploring video has changed how I think about reading and books and writing and embodied practice and even politics, even the idea of knowledge. So I think there are a lot of different ways to destabilize the relationship to literature. But the first thing to do is to notice what the technique of reading is, right? Is to say, well, how are we currently reading? What are our current techniques of reading and writing and thinking? So how do I read? What do I do when I read? And what do I do when I talk about what I've read? What do I do when I write? How do we engage with books, essentially? How do we engage with writing? And then, because then from that starting point, then you can say, okay, well, where else could we draw in some techniques? What other ways of doing that might there be? And of course, I mean, I didn't mention, but of course, all of theater and performance studies, arguably, is full of, you know, it's made of other techniques of dealing with text. So you can, of course, stage text. You can treat text as dramatic text. I've been for several years teaching a course where I treat nonfiction books as the starting point for a performance, for a devised performance. So we don't actually perform the book, but we read the book closely, and then we make a performance in response to it. That's a particular approach, but certainly it activates a different way of relating to the book than a standard seminar where you read it and discuss it.
Right. I watched the video. You seem driven by the song. Alice Walker says, and I'm paraphrasing here, "We must do the work our soul must have." It seems that you are doing soul work. Why do you do that work? What moves you to do this work? And also, you said in the video, which is attached with the video, that the video suggests song and action has as much power as words to shape the active and creative work of the memory. And to be honest, when I listened to the video, to the music, and how you mix between the music and the writing, the annotation, I feel, and I remember the Holocaust, as if it reveals the Holocaust.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good starting point, actually, for what motivates me. I certainly grew up with a very strong awareness of the Holocaust, the European Holocaust, and that was a big part of my childhood, I think, was that context. As I've gotten older, and as I've engaged with both a wider artistic field and a wider critical field, I see that was a specific cultural context for me to grow up in. I grew up very aware of my Jewishness in that way, but also not in any religious relationship to Jewishness. So not with any, I mean, I had almost no relationship to any kind of embodied technique of Jewishness, such as singing or prayer or anything like that. Almost none. I think my Jewishness was composed, in a sense, probably half of it was this huge awareness of the Holocaust, and the other half of it was this specific relationship to cultural Jewishness in the U.S. through comedy and musical theater and the kinds of places that link to that, and this kind of noting of that person, you know, that scientist is Jewish and that artist is Jewish, and just kind of noting that. I think the other part of that, which is the profound assimilation of Jewishness, of European Jews into the U.S., this becoming white of Jews, and so the whiteness of the context in which I grew up was not nearly as explicit. I mean, I was aware of it in some way, but not the way that I am now. And I don't think I had a critical view on it at all. I wasn't taught any kind of critical view on my own whiteness, except I think I was given something like this understanding of, like, you know, we're white, we have this white privilege, but we're also Jewish, and it's important to think about those things together. And that's it. And so kind of like, that's been a big question for me. How do I think about these things together? It only gets more and more urgent. Now, I mean, that video, the diaspora video, of course, in the video, my mom is in the video. And so it has that particular video has a much more personal kind of thing going on in it than some of the other videos, in that it's really about me and my family and my kinship relations and my diasporic experience. In the larger project, I'm I'm not the larger project. It's I guess ethnographic is the word. It has a kind of autoethnographic dimension. In the larger project, I'm not really trying to be autoethnographic, because as much as that's interesting to me, and as much as that's an important aspect of it to me, what I'm really looking for is how to activate Jewishness, or what there's a scholar named Santiago Slobodsky, who's written a book called Decolonial Judaism, which is about the failure, the repeated failure of European and now white Jewishness to really engage with its own political history, which means acknowledge, you know, to grapple with its complicity with whiteness, to grapple with its specific positionality, to recognize that the Holocaust is not the only Holocaust, and to kind of put all that history of Europe in the history of colonialism and in the wider global histories. And so now I think of all the questions around Jewishness for me are intimately related with all the questions of racialization. Questions of colonialism, contemporary Islamophobia, all of these kind of political things. It's kind of like how to articulate a position on that. And I think there certainly are plenty of white Jews and also non-white Jews in the U.S., at least that I know of, who are creating institutions that are articulating that position, that decolonial Jewish position, in a very powerful way, in an activist way. I think there are some doing it in an artistic way, although I'm not sure I know the examples of that. But I guess I've taken that as a kind of case study for my methodological work and said, well, somehow this position, whatever it is, this decolonial Jewish position I'm looking for, it's not going to be just a critical one. It's not going to be just that position of analyzing sociologically the history of colonialism and the history of anti-Semitism and the history of Islamophobia, like, and Orientalism. Is not just, that's essential, but it's not, it can't only be that. There needs to be an embodied dimension that's related to performing arts and healing arts, and there's a lot of thinking now I'm watching on my social media feeds about trauma in relation to racialization in the US, but obviously much more broadly. And that dimension, how do we bring that in, and how do we make work that's not only words, but it's also not I never thought that I was going to be sort of a singer, like a person who, because there, and there's, that can also be a great, you know, you can also find these kind of radical positionings through making art. And I always ended up between, where it was like, well, I want to make art, but I don't want to let go of all that critical thought, and I want to do critical thought, but I don't want to let go of my body. So that video for me, not only that video, but several of the videos, but that one included, I think that's the best one formally so far. But that whole project where we were making those videos was a huge kind of healing and integration for me, because I felt like, I don't know what I don't feel like I've arrived at any clear political position. I think even in the current moment, I feel still that in some way I'm watching from the sidelines and just saying, yes, do it, you know, take down the statue, great. But I feel that I can find, or I'm looking for, a more public way of appearing. I don't think I've found it yet, but I do think that in that project in 2017 was the first time that I felt like there might be a form in which I could appear, because of the way that I could be fully immersed in singing and moving and storytelling and really go there, but at the same time later be able to write on top of that and to put those annotations on. That revelation just felt like, okay, if there is a way that I could really kind of manifest what I think and what I hope and what I'm looking for and what I believe, it will have to be through this kind of video form, where I can appear as a singing, moving, vulnerable person with my features and who I am. But also, I'm going to be able to put books in the space. I'm going to read from the books, and I'm also going to write on the videos, so that I'm going to be able to use the citations. I'm going to be able to cite Slobodsky and Judith Butler and the people that that I need to cite to give the context for that. So Yeah, that's what appears for me. And I think you're the second person who used that phrase, soul work, and asked me a question about soul work. And I think it's this trying to integrate these parts and searching for this kind of way to be at service, of justice and of love, in a way that's like, I just want to bring more of myself. And that's not, you know, it's not just a personal question. It's not just like, oh, well, how do I integrate myself? My problem. It's a formal question also, because in a book, in writing, you can't bring certain parts of yourself. And if you're making an album of songs, you can't bring certain parts of yourself. And of course, I'm not saying that this video form brings all of you. Obviously not. Any form is just a limited form. But that form for me, it was like an opening towards integrating different parts of myself.
Right. You talked about gender. You make the argument that gender is an embodied technique that pulls together unconscious habits associated with social norms. With more conscious modes of embodied technique, we do gender unconsciously, but also sometimes make gender into a bodily project. Here, gender is linked to politics. What do you want to say?
I want to, first of all, recognize the work that's been done on gender and sexuality in the last decades, and I'm thinking of primarily in the US because that's what I'm familiar with, to recognize it as research, first of all. I think that really changes how we think about it. I think there's an older way to think about it as, again, as just kind of culture and cultural change. Like, oh, these people, you know, oh, look, these people are now doing it this way. Isn't that interesting? But it's just for them. Kind of subcultural approach. And then in Butler and in other theorists of gender, there's another approach, which is that it's a more politicized approach. Like, it's a kind of resistance. But there's a limitation that I still find in that, because it's still kind of saying, it's still a framework of resistance to the mainstream or to the hegemony of gender. It's still kind of not able in some way, I think, to fully name what it's doing. And if we see gender and other identities, not as just cultural differences, but also not as only resistance to the kind of structures, but if we see them as experiments and proposals of alternative structures, something opens up there to rework how we develop these things. And I don't want to underplay the extent to which it is, what I am talking about is resistance, and the extent to which there can be political backlash. Like, I certainly don't think that by framing gender or identity as technique, you kind of escape the power mechanisms that will prevent you from doing things. I mean, you don't escape them. They are still there. They are still gonna stop you or cause you harm and violence if you start to enact other gender technique in public, or in some cases even in private. So I'm not, you know, we still need all of the forms of political activism. I'm not questioning that at all. I'm saying, how does specifically the university, for example, further activate its alignment And its solidarity with activist movements without just becoming an activist. I mean, without, right, because if I think about decolonizing the university, always the first option is to abolish the university. But I'm not in that place. I don't want to abolish the university. I want to change the university. And so I'm not, you know, so then there's this question, well, how do we activate these theories of gender? How do we activate these theories of gender in a more active way? And that has to do with acknowledging all the research that's already been done. So all of the gay and lesbian and queer and trans and now non-binary practices that have been developed to say, okay, these aren't just cultures, and they're not individual identities. I'm happy to call them identities, but only if we understand that identities are fields of research. And also because the work that's gone into them, there is the work of resistance. There is the work of political resistance and of putting yourself on the line. But that is in dialogue with and grounded on the embodied work of actually discovering who you are and how it's possible to be. You know, you can't mobilize for, let's say, non-binary identity. You can't argue for it or make space for it or clear space for it if it doesn't exist. It has to exist first. Trans identity has to exist first. Queerness has to exist. And I don't think these are just terms. They are terms, but they come out of practices. They come out of practices of being, practices of interrelation, kinship, sexuality, family, counter-family, public, counter-public. They're embodied experimental practices. And I want to envision the university. I mean, really, to be honest, I want to envision the university. There are so many people now, particularly more and more urgently. With the pandemic, it becomes more urgent. With the huge Black Lives Matter protests, it becomes more, like, it only becomes more urgent, not to mention the climate crisis. Like, the university has to be really deeply reconfigured if it's not just going to be abolished along with white supremacy. So if anyone's going to do that, it needs to become a place where all of these things that are kind of put into a box as identities are recognized as fields of knowledge. So all of the gender work, all of the sexuality work, kinship, I mean, just in my own life, the way that parenting is excluded from the university, non-binary identity also is excluded. I mean, I often come out as non-binary, but it doesn't have any lasting effect. But also, I mean, of course, disability, sickness is also excluded from the university. So many things are excluded from the university and made into objects of study, but not recognized as methods and fields in their own right. So I can't really picture what that university looks like necessarily. And maybe it doesn't look like a university at all. Maybe it looks like a nation. I have no idea. But I think that's kind of the direction that I want to move and for me, that's the direction suggested by performance studies. Like, it's nothing radical. As soon as you say we're doing performance studies, everything can be a performance. You're going to have to eventually let go of the hegemony of text. And you're going to have to recognize the white supremacy and the predominant whiteness of the institutions. And you're going to have to recognize the patriarchy and the heteronormativity of all these things. And you're going to have to say, wow, there's a lot of fields of knowledge that we have never recognized, that the university has never recognized as fields of knowledge. In fact, the fields of knowledge that the university does recognize are actually quite small. They're these very small things, you know, like the field of history, the field of anthropology, the field of physics or biology. I'm not saying they're not important. I'm saying they're small compared to the fields of religion. And I don't mean religious studies. I mean the fields of the practice of religion, the fields of the practice of nation, the practice of gender, the practice of sexuality, the practice of racialization. Those are huge fields. And again, I'm not saying that any of the critical distance of the university can be easily discarded, because you don't simply want to take gender or race and structure the university according to it. Absolutely not, because then you're just absorbing the hegemonic structures that the university in some cases is specifically trying to resist. So it's a question of developing methods and frameworks where we could say, at least we need to recognize that gender and race and nation and ethnicity and religion and class and ability and all of these things, they are fields of knowledge. So we need to think about them as fields of knowledge, as methodologies. We need to change who we think of as experts and where we understand research to be taking place. And it is a kind of explosion of the university or an abolishment of the university. But at the same time, there are some tools. There are some critical tools, textual tools, methodological tools, which are still going to be important, I think.
That's great. In relation to gender, as a director, when you are working with the people, how you approach their differences for each other and from you?
That's a really great question. And it's really interesting that you said as a director. So, I'll tell you what's happened in my own artistic practice. I've separated out the role of project leader from the role of director in the theatrical sense. And I've actually separated the role of director as well using video. I've separated the role of director into the person who is a director in a given moment. So the person who's actually saying, okay, why don't you try this? Go faster, go slower. Can you do it again? That person. From the person who's making a composition of a work that can then be published or shared. So I've tried to separate, that's at least three different types of directing. There's the person who gathers everyone together and says, let's do a project over the next 6 months. There's the person who says in a specific moment, okay, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that to someone who's practicing? And there's the person who composes a work for the public. And I've tried to separate those quite rigorously, basically because I've had a lot of bad experiences, and I know a lot of people have had a lot of bad experiences, and we all know a lot of people who have had a lot of bad experiences with the possible tyranny of the director when those things come together. The way that has developed in the tradition of director's theater, for example, where one person says, come together, then they tell you what to do, and then they decide what it's about. And then they publish it for the world. And that power is all located in the same body. I'm not saying that can never be ethical, but for me, it's been really profound to disaggregate those powers. So I don't any longer hold that kind of directorial power where I would be in a position to give people directions and then decide what's happening and then make a composition and publish it and all these things. I do have some of those. I mean, I do have those powers at different moments, but I've tried to break down that power. And that is partly because I want to find other ways at getting at the differences between us. And especially because, you know, as I'm suggesting, the differences between us are not just individual differences, and they're not even just power differences. They're also differences in knowledge, in that we each bring different knowledges into the space. So how can we expose those knowledges in more complex ways and in more ethical ways, and ways that respond to contemporary political problems as well? Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it is for me. It's about understanding that, I guess it's about separating the different roles from the identities and knowledges that we bring. So one of the profound experiences that I had about 10 or 15 years ago, 12 years ago, that led me to where I'm at currently, before I wrote that book and before everything, was discovering that I was working with a partner. And we started to, initially I was directing her and she was in the performer role, because I had a lot of theater experience and she didn't have any theater experience. So it made sense for me to direct her. But then we started switching where I would direct her and then she would direct me. And I found that it didn't matter at all that she had no theater experience because we weren't trying to make a theater piece. What we were trying to do was understand embodied practice. and understand who we are and have a meaningful encounter, which could potentially then later be shared with other people. But we weren't in a position where we needed directing craft or directing chops to come in and say, all right, well, you know, you have to do it this way. Make sure you blah, blah, blah. We weren't oriented towards a product in that way. So it didn't matter that she didn't have directing skill because she had all these other skills and all these other knowledges and abilities which she brought. And what we learned by switching back and forth between the roles, I thought, was much more profound than anything we could have learned if I stayed in the role of director. So everything I've been doing is based on that. And I think for me, if I come into a space and I'm the director and I'm in the position of being the director of the show, there isn't any way that I can really access, this is personal, I don't know, I have to think more about this, but it seems to me, at least for me, there isn't any way that I can meaningfully access or encounter the profound differences between the people in the space. It's like, you know, if I have my institution and I invite people to come and participate and I try to include them, thinking about Sarah Ahmed on being included, and I try to include people in my institution, but it's my institution and I set all the rules, it's not necessarily going to be possible to there's a lot of aspects of them that's just not going to arrive. And so the answer I would say is the way that as a director of projects, as a director of research projects, the way that I work with differences is by trying to structure encounters where the various kinds of power that exist are circulating and moving between different people. So it's very important to me. I mean, I don't feel that I've met someone if I've just directed them. I often feel that I've met them more if they've directed me. But even more so if we've both directed each other. And even more so if we've both directed each other and a video was made of that, and then each of us has created a video essay of a based on that session that we did. Because then I'm seeing who they are as a performer, who they are as a director, and who they are as a thinker and an editor who's working with that material and maybe giving a title to what happened. And you know, I might say, well, this was about singing. And they might say, no, I think it was actually about breath. Or they might say, no, I think it was actually about citizenship. You know, there's a lot of different, whatever it could be about. So I'm looking to create forms, by which I mean methods, to circulate powers so that it isn't just this director coming in and saying, oh, wow, there's a lot of difference in the room. How can I work with that? I'm not comfortable in that role. And I know some people are. I'm not comfortable in that role. I'm comfortable when the power is mobile and when I can be the director, but I can also be the performer. Other people are the director. Other people are the video editors. We're having conversations, and there's a kind of form that's allowing us to interact in various different ways so that our differences come out not only as identities, but also as fields of knowledge. And that is kind of what it's about, right? Because if I come in as a director looking at a cast of performers, I might just see them and say, oh, they have a lot of difference. What, you know, there's a lot of difference in this room, but I have to be thinking in terms of composition of a work. So how do I compose them? And I'd rather come in and say, there's a lot of difference in this room, including me. How do we open this up? How do we allow the difference to manifest in a much deeper way? And that's through varieties of relationships and relationships between people and relationships to different kinds of document as well, which is why writing and video are also both still important. That the differences between people don't come out immediately. You know, that's the whole point. They come out through sustained encounters and relations and experimentations that you learn to understand, oh, that's who you are because of that's what you know. You know all these things that I couldn't possibly have imagined that you knew when we met.
It's great to, as a director, you call for a kind of transparency, which is, you know, the differences such as gender is very significant in the outside world, which cannot be significant in the inner world of the studio. So there is a kind of transparency between the actors, between the between the relationship between the director and the actor, it will be great. I think the differences will be demolished. Yes.
Yeah.
The other questions, are you tired? Are you tired?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm good.
Yes, there is a lot in your description of the theater space as one in which this body appears, this transparent body, or one that is catching fire or proliferating differences. As a performer, which are the moments when you feel that your inexperience are coming out to spectators?
That's why I asked that to Ibn Nagel Rasmussen, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're asking me that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for me, personally, it was this very profound moment when I realized that I could be directed by someone else, and that could be video recorded, and I could then edit the video. Because, you know, I've made solo performances where I was the director, but something happens when you're directed by someone else, or at least it does for me. There's something, and I think this is true for anyone who enjoys and is rewarded by the role of actor or dancer in that sense, where there's a choreographer or there's a director. You know, you discover. You go into parts of yourself that you wouldn't go into if you're only your own director. You discover things, and so there's this very beautiful, valuable, empowering mode of essentially vulnerability, where it's like I'm doing something and I invite someone else to tell me what to do, literally to tell me what to do. Which is funny because as a kid, I was really well known by my schools as someone who you could not tell them what to do. You know, I always got in trouble. I was always sent to the principal's office for just not for being aggressive at all, but just for not following orders, just for kind of saying, you want me to do that, but I don't want to do that. I, you know, in like second grade, I'm saying, oh, I don't want to do that. I'm going to do something else. And yet, as I grew up, I found that there's something great about being told what to do if it's in a context where you feel that there's an integrity and an ethics to the whole space, if you trust the person who's telling you what to do. But also, in this process that I'm talking about with video, even if you don't totally trust the person who's telling you what to do, what's important actually is the power dynamics in relation to the final product. And that's what I always found, is that the problem for me with theater when I was an actor was it wasn't that I didn't want to do what the director said. It was that I didn't want my whole self to be a unit of composition in someone else's artistic work. But I also didn't want to just make solo works or make works in which I was the director and also a performer. So this kind of way of working with video and performance and books and practice has given me this idea that, you know, one can appear in different ways. But I think that for me, that vulnerability is really important, the vulnerability of the performance. I think a lot of actors feel that in relation to the audience. So they might feel like even if they don't totally trust or completely agree with the director's vision, they still have a kind of direct meeting with the audience. I never felt that, I think, because I have such a critical mind and I'm such a critical thinker and a visual thinker also. And so I always wanted to have some kind of say over the final work and especially this articulation of what the work is about. I wanted that to resonate with my own experience in the work, but it didn't mean that I want to have control over everything. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I asked that to Ibn because, I'm trying to differentiate that body, that kind of what she calls, I think, the radiant body, and Grotowski, Jerzy Grotowski, of course, was calling it the performer. I'm trying to distinguish that from the kinds of icons of virtuosity that we see in all our movies and advertisements, where we have these highly athletic bodies that fit certain beauty standards that are also racialized and gendered in particular ways. And that's kind of the image of the radiant body. And I'm trying to really deconstruct that and really get away from that, and also break that down in myself and get away from my own, or at least recognize my own attraction to that and complicate that. While still honoring that, while still thinking about the body, like still thinking about how do we think about the body in all its unfolding capacities. And I think thinking about power and thinking about vulnerability has been really important for me in that, and that power and vulnerability, you know, those terms, as I'm thinking about them, they're very hooked into large-scale political and indeed sociological discourses, but they also happen on a micro level. And they happen on a micro level in everyday life where gender and race and sexuality and nation and religion and ability are enacted in everyday life. And what are the forms and the tools by which we can allow those things to appear? That's been where I feel, you know, I ended up kind of feeling that I that's where I feel, I guess the word is transparent, not in a kind of romanticized way, not in any final way, but that feeling, for example, of being directed by someone and having that be recorded so that I'm in a kind of vulnerable moment or I'm doing something that unexpected for myself and I just kind of appear in this way I couldn't have predicted. But then I get to take that video and I get to write on it and say what it's called and say what it means. That felt like a certain kind of transparency. It's not the end of the transparency, but it was quite important to me. And I think it's related to a lot of what's happening in practice research and artistic research and all these forms where people are saying, hold on, there's huge parts of me that are not showing up in academic forms. And that could be because I'm a dancer or a singer, or it could be because my identity formations don't match with the university expectations. But whatever the reason is, my embodiment is not coming into these university forms. So we need new forms.
Great. Dr. Spatz, in your talk about embodiment, you differentiate between three things: tinkering, attuning, and tracking. What do you mean by this? And tinkering, do you mean by tinkering absurdity?
Absurdity.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, they're not terms that I really have done a huge amount of work on. They only appear in that one paper. So they're more, I mean, in contrast to technique, which I really feel like I really want to offer technique, like let's really think about technique. With tinkering, tuning, and tracking, they're more just a kind of gesture for how we could think about the complexity of embodiment. Like I don't think that those three are particularly comprehensive or particularly important ways of thinking, actually. I just think it's helpful to realize that to start thinking about the complexity of what we mean by embodiment. And I took those terms, you know, the point of that article is not so much the specifics of the differences between tinkering, tuning, and tracking. It's actually, the point is the way in which those nuances between tinkering and tuning and tracking have been developed and explored in research that looks at craft traditions and at laboratory science. And just to say, look at how much care and how much work has been done to think about how scientists develop scientific knowledge. And similarly, look at this huge field of kind of craft studies and linked to anthropology, of how people work with and develop particular ways of making things and ways of working with materials. And also with plants and with other kinds of things. Why hasn't performance studies and theater studies looked with that amount of care at, for example, what we call actor training? And, you know, there's a lot of work on actor training now. And I think it increasingly does have that level of nuance. But still, I think there's a tendency, you know, I still think the magnetic pull of the theatrical production in that context is so strong that even very open-ended conversations about training still have this tendency to go towards training for what? What does it allow you to do? What's the skill that that's bringing? Or on the other hand, what's the practice that's happening in the room, but in a kind of cultural analysis, rather than activating the trainers and the practitioners in the way that it does if you think of them as researchers. So yeah, I mean, tinkering, tuning, tracking, they are, it's really just to point towards the different ways that we, and not to say that they're comprehensive, but just how differently we relate to our embodiment at different times. In that, you know, sometimes it is this kind of awkward messing about. Does this work? Does this work? What do I do? You know, this kind of feeling of like, how do I operate my body? It's not working how I expect. And sometimes it's more of a purposeful, I want to get there. And how do I bring myself into alignment? And that's kind of this tracking thing is more what we usually think of as training. And there's also this tuning. But I think, I guess I would say, if I really were going to try to develop a kind of a vocabulary for that, I would just take those three terms as a starting point. I wouldn't say, you know, let's divide embodied practice into tinkering, tuning, and tracking. I would much rather say, let's make an encyclopedia or a keywords book where we're going to talk about all the different ways that we work with embodiment. Not all the different ways, but enough that it feels unlimited. So let's come up with 100 ways. So tinkering, tuning, tracking, what else? You know, how do you do embodiment? And how do you, and then think about all the categories of all the performing arts, martial arts, healing arts, and then the different fields of identities in terms of when do you tinker, when do you track, when do you attune, but also what else do you do? So it's meant as a kind of opening in that way.
Yeah, great. I'm really admired by the film quotation.
The what?
Give me, by the film quotation, I'll read it. A quotation. Give me a lab and I will raise the world. How can connect between your theory and issues such as climate change, refugee crisis, and racism?
Yeah, I'm also really inspired by that. That's from Bruno Latour, right? And he's looking at the invention of penicillin. And he's talking about how a small discovery in a small space can have massive implications because we are all connected by threads of what I'm calling technique. In a sense, it's not different from something like this phrase, I don't remember who this is by, but this phrase that circulates as almost as a meme, do not doubt that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. But I think the difference is that meme is thinking in terms of power. I think it's thinking strategically in terms of power relations, and Latour is thinking in terms of knowledge. And of course, those things can't be separated. The radical political the political activism has to be based on an actual vision of alternatives. But I do find myself, in the first part of my life, at least, in the first part of my life, more aligned with trying to develop alternative visions than with trying to convince people that they should be doing that. I feel quite uncomfortable, even when I completely agree with a political with a political orientation, I still feel quite uncomfortable yelling about it or trying to convince people, kind of coming out with like, you need to do this. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not that I don't like accept certain statements as like, let's, you know, let's go forward with this and let's support this in every way I can. It's just that I don't find myself going out to convince everybody of it. I find myself in a smaller place, which is yet in another way not smaller, because if you are engaging with questions that other people are asking, and if you're accountable to the questions that others are asking, and if you're accountable to the knowledge that others have already discovered, then, as Latour suggests, potentially you can make some small discoveries which might have a wider effect without necessarily being the one to champion them. I think all of that work is important, and it has to be shared, and you have to kind of figure out what your role is. But for me, that idea of the laboratory, yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the university. I'm looking at the technology of the book, at the technology of writing, the hegemony of writing in relation to the Eurocentric history of the institutions that I work in relation to the whiteness of those institutions, the colonialism, the neoliberalism, the capitalism that are more and more structuring those institutions. And in a lot of ways, I feel powerless in those institutions. But I feel like one thing that I have, that I feel I can do, because I've been doing it very single-mindedly for, in a way, my whole life, or at least a couple of decades, second half of my life, is kind of get really deep into those problems of epistemology and methodology, and what counts as knowledge, and who has knowledge, and who's doing research, and what it means to do research, and what rigor is, and what it is to have objectivity or distance, and how, because those things all directly relate to climate change and racism, and they're not separate. Like, that objectification, that hegemony of the text, that profound move of distancing, that profound commitment to a kind of disembodiment, is linked to those things, but it's not linked in an obvious way where you just can say, we just have to convince everybody to change such and such. I think it's linked in a complex way. I think it's linked in a way that has to be unpacked and figured out, in terms of, well, okay, recognizing those histories, what does research look like? What kind of research do we need? What does a laboratory look like? What does knowledge look like, given the strengths of the contemporary moment, which, you know, we are seeing the strengths of the internet and circulating video, are undeniable in this moment. I mean, the kind of connectivity, for example, this conversation that we're having, this presentation, but also all of the protest videos that are flowing all over the world. I mean, that's a strength as far as I'm concerned in terms of building other possible societies. But it goes along with the catastrophic risks and dangers of just the massive exploitative mechanisms of production, and particularly of the circulation of weapons, but also the circulation of surveillance, which is another form of, you know, which is also the circulation of video. So the question of who controls the video, and who controls the circulation of texts, and who controls the internet. I mean, I don't feel able to directly, anywhere, you know, as Latour says, give me a laboratory and I'll raise the world. It's kind of leverage image. So you need to have somewhere to stand to make the lever. And I don't know where to stand in terms of changing who controls the internet, you know, because I use the internet, but I don't have access to those power structures. But what I did find is I could reappropriate a camera And, you know, I could say, oh, we're all carrying mobile phones. Like, how else could we use the camera? What is the power of the camera? What is this power? Because the camera has huge power. And just to kind of discover, for example, that you don't have to... The power of holding the camera isn't the same as the power of owning the footage that you record. So, for example, I've been leading these workshops that are the very kind of basic elements of this laboratory method that I've been developing. One of the things I do that's very small but very precise is, and this came up out of that project that I mentioned, one of the things is to say, okay, there's going to be a video recording of, let's say, of you. You're going to be asked to move or to sing or to recite some text, to read something. And we're going to make a video. Someone else is going to make the video. Now, that's very powerful, right? And you might feel vulnerable with someone else holding the camera at you. But they're going to hold your camera. You're going to have, you know, it's going to be your phone. Or if you don't have a phone, it'll be a camera where you control that material. So what if, for example, we started with the assumption that when someone is video recorded, they are the author of the video, not the person holding the camera. It's, you know, who knows if that can be taken up? Who knows what that can mean? I mean, can you build a legal system on that? That, you know, I don't know. But I know that that's a really different way of dealing with the camera. I know that these, you know, when we walk around and cameras record us everywhere, we don't own the material. It's the person who holds the camera, whether it's a surveillance camera, a camera on a drone, a camera at a protest, you pick up the camera and you record somebody, and it's just kind of assumed that you own that material, even though there's the you know, it's very complex because you get into the copyright of images. But there are other ways. So I guess I try to make it manageable by working in these micro situations and saying, well, what about just the dynamics of us in the room? What are the power dynamics of the director, the actor, the camera, the editor of the camera material, the person who reads the books or chooses the books? The funding, and how does that change in different locations? So investigating these issues on a micro level, I guess I believe that a rigorous investigation of issues, of problems, can generate knowledge that can be important. So whether it's climate change or racism or something else, and those are related, I feel like one of the things that we need to do is understand better what the basic dynamics are, but in a way that is not only private. You know, I'm not talking about when I say small, if I say micro scale, it doesn't mean it's private. It doesn't mean it's individual. And that's what a laboratory is, I think. And even in Latour's terms, you know, a laboratory is a place where you can do something that's small, that's micro, but it's not private. It's not individual. It's not my personal experiment. It's outward facing, it's accountable to fields of knowledge, and so potentially you can offer something.
Great. I have to stop here, Dr. Spatz. You really highlight some points on the new subject, which is new to all, as a student and as teachers. And I'm sure my students, teacher as well as teachers, were thinking deeply on your subject, on your theory. It is a very great, it is very interesting, and we look forward for more cooperation between us, between us as a university and you, the University of Huddersfield. Thank you very much.
That would be great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Spots. Thank you. Yeah.